Well, first of all, David, thanks for joining us again. You and I spoke not that long ago after The Wager came out, and we so enjoyed the book and your conversation. And having seen not only that the movie is coming out of The Killers of the Flower Moon, but that the book has percolated back up to the top of the New York Times bestseller list, I thought, well, let's reach out to you again. So thank you once again for some of your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's always great to chat with you.
Evidently, people are discovering the story for the first time based on the popularity of your most recent book and maybe the movie that is coming out. So while the story was written some time ago, why don't you just tell us what the premise is for The Killers of the Flower Moon?
It's about members of the Osage Nation in Oklahoma who, in the early parts of the 20th century, had become among the wealthiest people per capita in the world because of these vast oil deposits under their land. And then they began to be serially murdered under these extraordinary, mysterious circumstances. There was a bombing, there was shootings, there were poisonings, and it really was one of the more monstrous crimes and racial injustices in American history.
In fact, it's ironic, isn't it, that they became so wealthy? And you waste no time reminding us of the kind of wealth they had. You right away say in 1923 alone, the tribe took in more than $30 million, the equivalent today of more than $400 million. This tribe of Indians in Oklahoma took in Native Americans, took in $400 million, the equivalent today in that one year alone. And it was money that the federal government would never have allowed them to capture, but they kept pushing them further and further away from civilization. They finally plopped them there in northern Oklahoma. That was the reservation, the land that the government had ceded to them. You can live there. Nobody else wants to. And lo and behold, there was this vast oil reserve underneath, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I mean, they had once laid claim to much of the central part of, the United States, an area all the way from Missouri and to the edge of the Rockies. And in the 1800s, Osage chiefs met with President Thomas Jefferson at the White House. He referred to the Osage as a great nation and said they would know, settlers only as friends and benefactors. But of course, very quickly, settlers began to drive them off their ancestral lands. And they had eventually been confined to a reservation in Kansas in the 1860s. And they were once more under siege by white settlers. And it was then that they had to eye and look for a new homeland. And they eyed an area that was in what was then Indian Territory. It's now part of Oklahoma. It was a large area. It was about the size of Delaware. But it was rocky and hilly, and most white settlers and farmers considered it worthless because they couldn't farm there. And so an Osage chief had stood up at the time, and he said, our people should move there because the white people will finally leave us alone, and we'll be happy there. And so they resettled in this area. And then, lo and behold, this area ended up, sitting on top of some of the largest oil deposits then ever discovered in the United States. And the Osage became extraordinarily wealthy. And this wealth belied long-standing stereotypes of Native Americans. And so reporters, would head out to Osage territory, and they would regale the readers often with great sensationalism, with prejudice, and describe the Osage with their terracotta mansions. It was said at the time was one American might own a car. Each Osage owned 11 of them. And many of those Osage had servants whom were white. And then it also provoked this really insidious backlash. And the U.S. government went so far as to pass legislation requiring many Osages to have white guardians to manage their fortunes. And this system, was not abstractly racist. It was literally racist. It was based on the amount of Osage blood. And if you were a full-blooded Osage, you were deemed, quote-unquote, incompetent, and you were given one of these white guardians who could suddenly tell you whether you get this toothpaste or, this car. And not only was the system prejudiced, it also ushered in one of the largest federally and state-sanctioned criminal enterprises, as many guardians began to embezzle and steal millions and millions of dollars from the Osage.
Or just kill them outright. What happened there?
So what happened when the Osage lands were about to be allotted, which was kind of the breaking up the communal ownership of their land by the federal government, they slipped into their treaty with the U.S. government what at the time seemed like a rather curious provision. It said, we shall maintain all the subsurface mineral rights to our land. And at that time, nobody knew that the Osage were sitting upon a fortune. And so they very shrewdly managed to hold on to this last part of their territory, a realm they couldn't even see. And they became, in many ways, the world's first underground reservation, because even as their surface land eventually disappeared, often into the hands of whites, they continued to control this subsurface area. And each Osage was given a headright, which is essentially a share in this mineral trust. And a headright could not be bought or sold. It could only be inherited. So what happened was these were essentially inheritance schemes. In order to get one of these headrights, which were worth a fortune, a share in this trust, white settlers were marrying into Osage families, pretending to love you, while then often systematically plotting to kill you, and sometimes even the children you had.
And about that, you focus on one family in particular. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, Molly was Burkhart, who's really the kind of soul of the book and the history I tell in the book, and also its conscience. She was really a remarkable woman. She was born in an Osage lodge in the 1860s, speaking Osage, practicing Osage traditions. And then she was forcibly uprooted from a home and made when she was a young girl to attend a missionary boarding school. And then within, you know, just a couple decades of her birth, because of the oil money, she was living in a large house. She had white servants. She had married a white settler from Texas, a man named Ernest Burkhart, and she had met him because he had been her chauffeur. And so Molly, in many ways, straddled not only two centuries, but two civilizations. And in 1921, her family begins to be targeted. One day, her sister, Anna Brown, who had been visiting her house, left and disappeared. And a week later, she was found in the ravine, shot in the back of the head. And it was the first indication that Molly's family was going to be targeted.
The amount of murders and deaths was staggering, wasn't it? Not to cut this family story short, it's central to your book, but it wasn't just them that were being targeted. Were federal, state, or local authorities suspicious of the death rate, particularly given the inheritance aspect of these, what did you call them, headrights?
Headrights, yes. I mean, you know, by 1923, the official death toll, just the official death toll, climbed to at least 24. And, you know, many of the Osage, including Molly, really crusaded for justice, often to great risk and peril to their own lives, go to the authorities, they would bring their evidence, they would bring their testimony, and yet they were often ignored because of prejudice at the time, but also because there was a great deal of corruption in law enforcement at that time, and many figures in law enforcement were complicit in these schemes. And so in 1923, the Osage Tribal Council issued a resolution pleading for federal authorities to step in. It was then that the case was taken up by the Bureau of Investigation, a then rather obscure branch of the Justice Department, which, of course, we know today as the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was later renamed and is the FBI. And it would become one of the FBI's first major homicide cases. And there were many twists and turns that investigation, but eventually they sent in some undercover operatives who tried to trace the money, in particular in the killings of Molly's family. And eventually that would reveal that the perpetrators were people whom Molly had known and loved and or thought she loved and trusted. As you point out, the death rate was even higher, more staggering than that 24, and that, you know, though the FBI was able to capture one of the killers and a couple of his henchmen, there really was a much deeper and darker conspiracy that the Bureau never exposed. And that this was really about a culture of killing and complicity. And that there were many cases where other cases that were never properly investigated, where a white person had married into an Osage family and killed the spouse in order to steal a headright. And there were also doctors who were administering poisons, and there were morticians who were covering up bullet wounds, and there were lawmen and prosecutors who were on the take, and there were many others who were complicit in their silence. And so the actual death toll was undoubtedly much higher than the official one of 24. And yeah, many of these cases were never properly investigated, never resolved as a result.
So insidious, isn't it? Because some of the sorts of schemes that might lead to this sort of death toll would be, well, I'll just steal from you, but I can only capture the money if I'm part of your family. So a trusted family member or friend who would, for instance, be giving one of the sisters insulin for her diabetes was, in fact, slowly poisoning her. it's just amazing that the men and women of the Osage tribe weren't more suspicious of the designs or interests of the people that were sort of insinuating themselves into their lives.
Well, I think it's complicated in that some of them would grow suspicious and the suspicions were ignored. But I also think when I interviewed descendants of some of these families, you know, some of the descendants of the murder victims, and they asked the most obvious question, which when you ask it, you understand. They said, but who would ever believe somebody was marrying into your family, pretending to love you, or trying to kill you? I mean, it was just so outside the normal bounds of almost, and so unfathomable. And that's what made these crimes so deeply sinister. They involve such a level of intimate betrayal. You know, again, these people who pretend to love you, or plotting to kill you. It really was unfathomable and such a revelation, dark revelation about human nature. And what it really gets at were these structural issues at the time and what happens when you take unbridled greed, which many of the white settlers had for the oil money, and fuse that with the dehumanization of another people. You know, one of the killers of the Osage said something to a lawman. I can't remember the testimony precisely, but he said something to the effect that, you know, we don't see killing an American Indian today any different than it was back in the 1700s. And that was the general attitude to many of these killers who did not see their victims as fully embodied humans with dignities and souls.
You mentioned when you tell that part of the story that on the stand he referred to the victim as the Indian, almost to remind whoever was listening that it's an Indian. It's not the same as a white person. And I get it. That really does connect in your telling of the story. The subtitle of the book is The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. We're talking about J. Edgar Hoover as a 29-year-old who's moving up the ranks. Yeah. And the nexus of those two stories is just amazing. So the movie is about to come out. Have you seen the film?
I have. I've seen it a few times, and it's a really remarkably powerful film, very faithful to the history and to the story. I think it gets at these deeper emotional truths. And what's so remarkable the film is that they work so closely with members of the Osage Nation in developing it. And, you know, when you see the film, you will see that, you know, they shot on location. They shot in the places where these crimes took place. The Osage were involved in building the sets and the costumes and making sure the Osage language was spoken correctly. And there are many Osage actors in the film, not just as extras, but also the speaking roles. And I think because of that, the film has a real authenticity and power about it.
Stars Robert De Niro, Leo DiCaprio, Lily Gladstone. It's the latest Martin Scorsese film, Killers of the Flower Moon. It opens October 20th. People, after having seen the movie, will then start to write articles about, is this part of the movie true or not? Is there something you want to get in front of, something extraordinary in the film that was especially true or maybe took license?
You know, with any film, it's a dramatization, so inevitably you're creating scenes. But they really cared about getting things right. They had a fierce commitment to getting things right. You know, there are not, you know, unlike a lot of Hollywood adaptations where these liberties, you know, are extraordinary, you know, they stick very closely to the essential facts of the story and the deeper truths of the story. And I think one thing that is important to, you know, the film focuses on it laser focuses on the relationship between Molly Burkhart and her husband, Ernest Burkhart, and that relationship. And it's just so powerful. It's very representational, the broad crimes that took place. I think one thing that is important for people who see the film, and I think one of the most important parts of the book, is to get at and to understand the breadth of these crimes and how systemic they were. And that would be one of the things I would just underscore. You know, for me, the third chronicle of the book is probably the most important part, where it kind of reveals and underscores how this was less about a singular evil figure who committed these crimes. Because we often like to think that way, because if someone is just evil, then we can kind of remove them and think they are different than us. But what happens when so many people are complicit and willing executioners in these crimes? We have to kind of re-examine what they were really about.
You know, what's also kind of sad in your telling of the story, I don't know if the movie captures this, is that so not everybody was going to marry them or kill them, but they were certainly going to take advantage of them. So the rates for services or the cost for goods that these Native Americans, these Osage, what they were charged was ridiculous. But they had so much money they could afford it. And so the economy was kind of twisted there, wasn't it?
Oh, I mean, the whole economy was twisted because I mentioned earlier on this guardianship system. And so these guardians were appointed to manage. I mean, think about this. You know, you could be an Osage chief and you would have a white guardian telling you how you could spend your money. Kind of unfathomable. But that system was so rife with corruption because a guardian would say, oh, okay, you want to get this car. Well, go get the car down. You have to get the car at this store. And then so you go get your car at that store, and that owner would then give a kickback to the guardian because you had made sure the car was bought there. So there were kickbacks. There were also what were referred to as Osage prices, because Osage prices were astronomically higher than the prices charged to whites in the period, because of, you know, it's just such an exploitative system. And these Osage prices were all approved by the guardians, and it was just embedded in the system. There's a very effective scene in the movie during a burial scene where they're saying, we're trying to get a casket, and they're saying, what are you doing? You're charging me Osage. There's a white saying, what are you doing? Charging me Osage prices, because the cost of a funeral was, you know, they're charging an unbelievable exploitive amount of money. And this whole system was referred to at the time as the quote-unquote Indian business. That's how they referred to it at the time. And it was a deeply corrupt system.
Killers of the Flower Moon, the Osage murders, and the birth of the FBI. The movie opens next week. And David, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on your new book back on the New York Times bestseller list. The Killers of the Flower Moon has been performing as well as The Wager. So these are good days for you.
Yes, thank you so much. Well, for me, the best thing about it all is, you know, I care very deeply about these parts of history. And so the notion that more and more people will be aware of it is just wonderful.
David, brilliant. Thank you, as always.
My pleasure. It was great chatting with you. Good luck with everything.
Yeah, likewise. Bye now.